Welcome to Dermatologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Keith Flaherty to chat about melanoma, and he began by commenting on one of the most active areas of current investigation, combining a BRAF inhibitor with a MEK inhibitor.
I think the easiest starting point in terms of how to try to build on BRAF inhibitor therapy is to learn from the really massive amount of clinical research and laboratory research that have gone on to understand resistance. And it's very clear that the BRAF pathway, which we refer to sometimes as the MAP kinase pathway, which is just the pathway in which BRAF sits, it's reactivated in the majority to vast majority of melanoma patients based on the research done on actual patient tumor specimens at the time of disease progression on vemurafenib or more recently dabrafenib, the other selected BRAF inhibitor. And when you see the pathway back on again and you don't see the type of mutations in BRAF itself that the oncologists who have been using erlotinib in lung cancer know about, these resistance mutations in EGFR, or certainly in CML or GIST where you see resistance mutations in the actual drug target, we don't see that. We see reactivation of the pathway through a variety of other mechanisms, and that's what justified these other drugs in the MAP kinase pathway, the so-called MEK inhibitors, MEK inhibitors, as being proposed as maybe being useful to try to sort of head them off at the pass, if you will, in terms of blocking these kind of workarounds that the tumors come up with to bypass the initial effect of a BRAF inhibitor. And that's the simple explanation behind all of the work that's been done combining a MEK inhibitor with a BRAF inhibitor. One paper has been published on that topic, but another separate investigation with a different BRAF inhibitor and a different MEK inhibitor have already been presented at a major meeting and validate the same observations that actually the two-drug approach clearly causes more upfront tumor response and substantially delays the time to tumors progressing or developing resistance. And thus far, anyway, the data would suggest that the side effect price that a patient pays is, if anything, less, not more, by having the two drugs on board. So that's the big advance that's emerging. But just to be absolutely clear, there are ongoing phase 3 trials with two different BRAF inhibitors, with two different MEK inhibitors that have completed accrual. We're waiting on the data. So for this to actually hit prime time, you know, for practitioners to be able to pull the two-drug approach off the shelf, we need just, you know, a few more months ahead in those results.
What do we know right now about the difference between BRAF inhibitors and MEK inhibitors, both in terms of their mechanism of action, the clinical efficacy, and their tolerability?
Well, I think the easy answer on mechanism of action and, frankly, efficacy is that these two types of drugs look very, very similar. They both block the same pathway, the MAP kinase pathway, and to a similar degree in the tumor cells that have a BRAF mutation. Now, I should mention, because you know, listeners are going to hear a lot more about MEK inhibitors being investigated in other cancer types than just those that have BRAF mutations. BRAF inhibitors, on the other hand, they only produce the effect I'm describing in cells that have a BRAF mutation, flat out. So they share a mechanism of action in the sense that they both block the same pathway in the tumor cell. Where they're very different, and this gets to not just mechanism but side effects, is that the two types of drugs have very different effects in normal tissues. And by that I mean the MEK inhibitor will block the MAP kinase pathway, but the BRAF inhibitor does not and cannot block the MAP kinase pathway in cells that don't have a BRAF mutation. And in fact, a variety of evidence supports the idea that the side effects from the BRAF inhibitors come from turning on that same pathway in normal tissue. So think of them as having almost opposite effects in normal tissue, but the same type of effect in tumor tissue.
But in terms of within a class, for example, of BRAF inhibitors, is it kind of like, for example, aromatase inhibitors, that they kind of are all acting the same way?
Yeah, that's a good question. We really know the most about the drugs that right now are being called selective BRAF inhibitors. Some people use the jargon, which isn't going to be very helpful in years ahead, the type 1 BRAF inhibitors. That is meant to leave open the description of these other less selective RAF inhibitors. Remember that BRAF is one of three RAF isoforms. There's CRAF, which is in fact expressed in just about all cell types, and is the one that actually had been studied in cancer biology for much longer than BRAF. There's BRAF, which is of course mutated and important not just in melanoma, but about 7 or 8% of all cancers. And then there's ARAF, about which we know almost nothing. And there are drugs being brought forward now and in clinical trials as we speak that block the RAF kinase family members in a little bit more of an even-handed way, different from these selective BRAF inhibitors. And so the thought is that those drugs could be useful in cancers that have BRAF mutations potentially, might even help prevent resistance, some of the ones that we've seen to these so-called selective BRAF inhibitors, and might have a role in other cancer types altogether. But important to remember is that these drugs might also have a very different toxicity profile because they'll block the RAF kinases collectively and not have this selective effect. And, you know, as everyone is aware with the sort of smartest of smart drugs in the targeted therapy realm for cancers that have a specific mutation, EGFR, ALK, and so on, you know, the more selective, the better, frankly, in terms of having an anti-tumor effect and not disabling toxicity.
Just a couple of side issues. I've always been kind of curious. It seems from what I've seen, at least I've seen some stuff in colon cancer, that BRAF inhibitors don't work in patients with colon cancer and BRAF mutations. Why is that?
Yeah, we have a set of laboratory experiments that address that point, but the clinical evidence is exactly as you summarize. Very uncommon responses to BRAF inhibitor therapy by itself in colon cancer. And disappointingly, the BRAF-MEK combination that I was just alluding to in melanoma that's really cruising along with very promising data, already published in one instance, the results of a randomized phase 2 trial. With those combinations cruising forward in melanoma looking very promising, the same two drugs reported at ASCO this past year still have fairly minimal activity in BRAF mutant colon cancer. So what that's trying to tell you, I think, is that the MAP kinase pathway by itself is just not going to be a standalone target in that tumor type. And what the laboratory evidence would suggest is that the epidermal growth factor receptor can quickly rescue these cells and drive signaling through other pathways altogether. In other words, you can do what you want against BRAF or even MEK, but if you don't take care of the epidermal growth factor receptor drive in these tumors, then they will rapidly resist the effective treatment. I don't mean acquired resistance, I mean right up front resistance.
So we have vemurafenib approved and being used, but another BRAF inhibitor, dabrafenib, along with a MEK inhibitor, trametinib, and another MET inhibitor called GADC0973. Where are we heading in terms of these agents over the next couple of years?
So first and foremost, of course, we have no head-to-head comparison of any of these drugs. That would be the nicest to have. So we're going to be left doing cross-trial comparisons. There are large data sets with each of these drugs, so that's, I guess, not a major challenge to be able to characterize the safety of each of the drugs and then, you know, obviously, to some degree, the efficacy. Dabrafenib and vemurafenib on the efficacy front look very, very similar. Their response rate, the progression-free survival, and the overall survival, even though it's always a little dangerous to compare across trials when you're starting to talk about those kinds of longer-term outcomes that depend on prognosis of the patients, that depend on the availability of other treatments, including some of the ones we'll talk about, promising new treatments that have come along, you know, in these same set of years. So I would say, you know, it's remarkable how similar those two drugs look on that front. But there are differences in terms of toxicity. There's no question that that's the case. If you simply look at the published reports, you'll get a feel that the overall rate of toxicity or likelihood of it is very comparable. But what makes up that list is different. And you certainly could find patients in practice, for example, who have great difficulty, let's say, with vemurafenib and its phototoxicity or, you know, sensitivity to the sun. Patients can really be very sensitive to that. And if they live in southern climates where, you know, their life is largely outdoors year-round, this can be a real issue. Dabrafenib doesn't have that problem. The flip side is, of course, that dabrafenib has some side effects that vemurafenib doesn't have. For example, there are fevers that can happen, and even repeatedly, on patients that receive dabrafenib. It's been well documented in several clinical trials. You look over at vemurafenib, you don't see that. So it could well be the case that you've got either a patient in front of you where you'd be worried about one set of side effects, you know, from one drug versus the other, and that would force maybe you to choose between them on that basis. Or imagine that you ran into trouble, you know, in the first month of treatment with one of the therapies from a side effect that really isn't so common with the other one. You might actually think about jumping ship and switching without waiting to see how things pan out in terms of tumor response or resistance.
What are the other major problems that occur in addition to the two that you mentioned, the pyrexia as well as the photosensitivity and skin problems?
Yeah, so rash is the main skin problem, but of course behind that is cutaneous squamous cell carcinomas emerging. And both drugs can do that. That's very clear. The rash, you know, can be a little different in terms of the type of rash that patients develop, so the severity of it in relation to the starting dose anyway. And so that's one that can certainly play out differently from patient to patient. I generally consider rash to be something you're stuck with these drugs, and that you basically have to be thinking about interrupting the dose and sometimes lowering the dose depending on the severity of it. Whereas arthralgia, for example, a bit more common with vemurafenib than dabrafenib. Liver function test abnormalities can show up with both drugs, but, you know, based on the published data anyway, seems a little more likely with dabrafenib than vemurafenib. So you get my sense here that basically there's, you know, some different frequencies here, even for some of the same side effects. But symptomatic side effects, you know, just to start from the top, cutaneous rash being, you know, the dominant one. Arthralgia comes close behind that. And then fatigue is the third. And so these other ones that I'm mentioning are ones that are more like, let's say, 10-20% of patients who can have an issue with any of them. Now, we know that it's okay to interrupt dosing. We know it's okay to lower the dose of both of the drugs. In fact, in clinical trials, that happened quite commonly. I mean, approximately a third of patients required dose reductions, and yet you still saw benefit accrue to those patients, not just those that could stick it out on full dose therapy.
So if we were to present to you, you know, the typical patient is about to go on a BRAF inhibitor, maybe symptomatic and needs a response, et cetera, you know, assuming it's not somebody who's a fisherman or something with a lot of sun exposure, are you going to choose one over the other, coin flip or what?
Yeah, I think it's a coin flip if you have a patient where the photosensitivity piece is not really pushing you, for example. To me, that's the biggest differentiator. So if they were a fisherman, that would make it easy. But otherwise, yeah, I think it is a coin flip. It's certainly, you know, based on efficacy, I'd say there'd be no grounds for picking one over the other. And on safety, as I said, in aggregate, the number of toxicities, the likelihood of having something in the realm of toxicity is just about the same as well. It's just an issue of the makeup of that list. So to be honest with you, and we're likely going to face this decision in clinical practice, you know, in the months ahead, it's not going to be an easy call. And I would almost argue, even in my own hands, being someone who's treated patients on clinical trials with these drugs, that I'm probably going to sort of use one in one patient, one in the other, and gain experience over time that might influence that decision a little bit more in terms of, you know, which one do I think is really more user-friendly, ultimately, from the treating physician side. Individual patients, of course, results vary highly from one patient to another. You've got, you know, a swath of patients on either drug who essentially report nothing in the way of side effects. So it's not like these therapies are just constant toxicity management and a headache.
Well, that was the other kind of question we've asked a lot of times in these surveys, and I'll ask it about these two drugs, which is, what would you say to a patient who says, what's the chance I'm going to cruise through this, kind of like taking a placebo?
Yeah, about a third, and another third who are going to have some side effects who, if you push them and say, well, can you put up with this? You know, is this manageable? They'll say yes. And that leaves you a third where you have to make some adjustments.
So what about the MEK inhibitor, trametinib? How's that going to fit in your algorithm? I mean, that's a third possible choice.
Yeah, and it's different. Now, here I would say that if you look at the efficacy data, and again, with all the caveats of cross-trial comparisons, it doesn't quite measure up to the BRAF inhibitors. The response rate isn't quite as high. The progression-free survival is not quite as high. Overall survival looks comparable, but again, a lot of concerns about only relying on that comparison. So I tend to put a little bit more weight on these sort of early outcome measures. And so I would say, faced with that evidence, on efficacy grounds, I would favor a BRAF inhibitor over a MEK inhibitor. Now, if you're worried about squamous cell carcinoma, by that I mean really worried, because someone's had a personal history of 20 of them, right? They've got actinic keratoses all over their skin. Okay, well then a MEK inhibitor is not going to cause you a problem there, because it does not induce MAP kinase pathway signaling in those cells and cause the proliferation of squamous cell carcinomas, simply put. The side effects are rash and diarrhea. Those are the big ones. It's been seen reproducibly with every MEK inhibitor, but this is the one, of course, that's potentially the first to make it to market. And the rash is different. It's acneiform, a little bit like an EGFR rash, but different from the BRAF inhibitor rash, flat out. And then diarrhea, something we don't deal with very often with the BRAF inhibitors, comes up with the MEK inhibitors. Beyond that, most of the side effects that can come up are really not substantial or treatment limiting in any real way. But as I said, I start my considerations with that efficacy bit and figure, you know, I'm probably going to prefer a BRAF inhibitor just about every time.
So again, in that situation, before we have the combined data, phase three data, first of all, would there be any point, assuming the patient tolerated it well, in using the other BRAF inhibitor after the first one in a patient who progressed after having a response?
Yeah, there might be, but let me couch the comment this way, which is that there are now an increasing number of patients, and in fact, this data has been presented at meetings, who have stopped treatment because of resistance. I mean, tumors were clearly growing, stopped treatment, and let's say maybe went on to another therapy that was unsuccessful. So let's call that like a 2 or 3 month holiday, came back to the same drug and have re-responded. It's a story that's been told in some of the other oncogene-targeted therapy.
EGFR, you hear exactly. That with erlotinib, yeah.
And so with that said, if people can respond to the same drug, obviously you'd imagine they could respond to the other drug, and there might be, although we don't have good evidence of sequential attempts with vemurafenib followed by dabrafenib or vice versa, I would take that experience of retreatment and say, yeah, I'd switch over to the other drug.
Would you switch over in a patient who had just progressed on the first one?
I would be thinking of trying something else in the meantime. I mean, in other words, what I mean by this is we think that there's some kind of biological resetting that's happening in these tumors, that if you rush straight from drug one to drug two, you're really asking this question about cross-resistance, you know, in a dead-on way. And given the similarity of how these drugs perform and every little bit of laboratory data that's been generated with them, I'd be very reluctant to believe that doing that would be any better than just continuing the drug you're already on through progression, which has happened in clinical trials with these drugs, phase one, phase two, and phase three. If patients had major responses and let's call it minor progression, they still weren't back up to where they were when they started. In those clinical trials, individual investigators were permitted to keep people on. You had to call it progression when you saw it, but you could then keep people going thereafter. So there actually is some experience doing that.
Yeah, I have heard from a lot of people, again, getting back to lung cancer in terms of ALK. I remember talking to Ross Kamage, but a lot of people talk about the idea of, you know, maybe one lesion breaking through, everything's still under control, and then you ablate it or do something, look, and just keep the drug going.
Right.
Do you see that being done in melanoma?
Yeah, there's two scenarios, and maybe we should, you know, focus the brain metastasis management in this era as kind of a separate point of discussion, but that's one. So a patient has brain-only progression, how do you proceed? But you're getting at more this issue that they started with 20 lesions, 10 lesions, whatever the number. They all went down. Only one of them's coming back up.
Or a new one showed up.
Exactly. And so in that situation, it's all the matter of where it is, because if it's in melanoma, you can have a subcutaneous metastasis, let's say. Well, then we remove it. It's that simple. If it's deeper, ablation, if feasible and safe, absolutely. And then radiation favoring more kind of highly targeted radiation methods over sort of conventional fractionated radiation in terms of the likelihood that you're really going to be able to put a dent in that thing.
So again, in this, you know, next phase that we might be coming into, where would you use the MEK inhibitor after the BRAF inhibitor?
That's been tried to just a small extent. Small cohort of patients that actually just snuck out into a publication, part of a larger study with trametinib. And that didn't pan out so well. The only two patients who responded out of a 26-patient cohort were the two patients who had stopped their previous BRAF inhibitor therapy because of toxicity, not because of disease progression. Everybody else had stable disease in some cases or outright progression. Now, I'm not saying stable disease is a bad thing, but these were pretty short-lived. And so if you had no other option and no other intervening therapy to turn to, as I said before, maybe thinking about coming back even to BRAF inhibitor therapy, I'd consider that. I'd certainly consider trametinib, you know, until we have more combination evidence, I would consider it as a single agent in that setting. Based on the clinical trial data, it's approved in BRAF mutant melanoma, any line of therapy, because it was tested in a phase three trial that included both first line and second line patients.
How would you feel about an oncologist trying to utilize the combination outside a trial setting?
Yeah, I think, I mean, my comfort level in thinking about that is that we've got in the published paper in aggregate about 250 patients represented there who got the combination. There was a phase one, large phase one, and then a randomized phase two component. And if you look at all of that data, it gives us a pretty good sense of what the safety profile is of this combination. And as I alluded to before, if anything, it's a little less problematic than either drug alone. And we can, you know, get into, you know, what we think the science is behind that. But that is the case. And with clinical data that you'd say, we obviously need the phase three trials to know for sure that it's superior. Is there a chance that the two drugs together would be worse than either drug alone? Well, I don't think that's a relevant concern. So you're sort of hoping that based on the relatively small number of patients treated, in the published literature that, you know, you're sort of hoping for that effect, but might you not get it? Yeah, that's a possibility. It goes back to your previous question. What are you going to do with trametinib by itself, right? What is its role? And if its role is hard to judge based on, you know, my view of things, having participated in these trials and having used these drugs now for the past several years, well, holding it back, keeping that bullet in your chamber, that's really not known to be of great value in its own right. So it's the other point. If we knew that sequential therapy was useful, BRAF followed by MEK, well, then I'd have concerns about the idea of jumping in with the two-drug approach. But we, in fact, have some evidence that it's not that effective in the sequential use. And so, therefore, I think it's pretty reasonable to be thinking about the idea of combination.
Could you comment a little bit on what has been seen with this particular combination in terms of tolerability? You alluded to the fact that it seems like somehow they balance each other out or something.
Exactly. So, you know, basically all the side effects that you expect to see with a BRAF inhibitor or a MEK inhibitor actually come down in their severity. So what we term grade 3 toxicity, for example, we know from the trametinib single agent trials, including the trametinib phase 3 trial, that there was an 8% rate of grade 3 diarrhea, you know, which, you know, for those who've used EGFR inhibitors or other drugs that can cause diarrhea, you'll know what kind of problem that can be. And with the combination, zero grade 3 diarrhea. That doesn't mean you don't see any, but it takes it down into this kind of mild or moderate realm at worst. Flip side, rash, common to both drugs, and different type of rash, a sort of patchy rash with the BRAF inhibitor, acneiform rash with the MEK inhibitor. Well, you don't see the acneiform rash with the two-drug combination. If you even see a rash at all, it'll be the more patchy BRAF type. But again, you don't see grade 3. You'll see less grade 2, and you'll see, if you see it at all, you'll typically see grade 1. And these, again, are the common side effects of each drug clearly being somewhat diminished. Fewer squamous cell carcinomas based on the published data. It wasn't a huge study, so it doesn't totally nail that down definitively, but certainly doesn't look like there's any more. And you know, the science behind this goes back to what I was talking about before with mechanism. BRAF inhibitors seem to cause squamous cell carcinomas, and if you look in even normal skin that has been biopsied on some of these trials, you'll see upregulation of the MAP kinase pathway. Well, MEK inhibitors will do the opposite. They will block the MAP kinase pathway, not just in the tumor cell, but even in the normal tissue. And we think that's what's going on here, is that they're basically having a canceling effect in some tissues, not all necessarily, but in the tumor, they're both having the same kind of positive effect in terms of blocking the pathway.
And it seems like less pyrexia.
Well, so no, that's the bad story. And sorry.
More pyrexia.
Yeah, more pyrexia.
Really?
It's the one thing that there's more of.
Huh.
So the rash and diarrhea, which are these sort of clear improvements, if you will, this discussion is complicated by the fact that pyrexia, which comes from dabrafenib, meaning trametinib by itself doesn't do it, is actually more of an issue. And in fact, in my use of single agent therapy versus combination therapy, I'd say, you know, this really, it can be a problem. I mean, there are patients who can really feel very sick. Fever, chills, rigors, I mean, the whole complex.
When does it start and what's the mechanism?
Yeah, difficult to predict exactly. It's not within the first few days, but you're talking, you know, within the first month or two, you'll see the first episode in some people, but it can be the third or fourth month in some people. You know, we haven't nailed down the mechanism and we've tried. In other words, when people have these febrile reactions in clinical trials, we've had them come in to the office, you know, same day or next morning, drawn blood samples, obviously work them up for infection, don't see infection. These drugs don't compromise the immune system by any account that we can judge.
Cytokines?
Exactly. So that's where the current evidence is accumulating, that there is kind of a cytokine storm. I mean, if you're going to have fever and chills, you imagine you got to have some kind of a cytokine burst going on there. But your question before was why? Why would this be happening? And the only thing we can come up with based on the time distribution of these events, the fact that they're not all happening within the first, let's say, 2, 3, or 4 weeks when the drugs are having, you know, plenty of their other effects, is that it must be setting something up in the immune system so that when something else comes along, you know, some viral pathogen or otherwise, you end up in this situation of your body kind of overreacting, if you will.
I'm flashing on some of the conversation I've had in other tumors, like pancreatic cancer, where I interview people and after about 10 minutes, you know, I sort of run out of things to talk about. And that was kind of the way it was with melanoma a few years ago. Now we've just 40 minutes and we haven't even gotten through BRAF positive disease yet. No, it's really, I mean, it's such a welcome difference. One other question before we get into the issue of immune-based therapy. I saw an article raising the issue of cost. of these new therapies in melanoma. Any comments about that?
We can stake the discussion around what we know, which is the approved drug. So vemurafenib has a retail cost of $9,600 a month. And so take that to your patient population based on the insurance mix you see. Patients who've got Part D coverage with Medicare, patients who've got cantankerous private insurance who aren't on Medicare.
That's CML kind of numbers.
Exactly. In fact, even a little higher, right? So it pushes the envelope in terms of per month cost for these therapies. Patients are on therapy on average 7-8 months. If you look at all the data, even in terms of their actual use in the real world, and some are on for a long time. In fact, a year or two. We've got patients who are still responding more than 2 years, although it's a small number. So my point being that when you're counseling a patient about the financial impact, admittedly, you don't know how long they're going to benefit from the treatment, but it could be a big investment if they've got, a substantial copay that they're going to be stuck with. And you can imagine why insurers are fighting a bit. And bridging over to immune therapy, we have ipilimumab, of course, is the recently approved drug. Retail cost there of drug alone, forget about ancillary cost of giving supportive treatments and so on, about $360,000 for four doses, which is the standard regimen, four so-called induction doses at every three-week intervals.
$360,000?
Correct. And that's it for the treatment, meaning you don't go beyond that, but you're still talking about a significant bolus of cost. And, it had its issues in terms of early adoption and really not being on the table for patients who don't have adequate insurance coverage.
Any other thoughts about that issue? I mean, we could talk all day about it and still probably not know what else to say, but I'm just kind of curious how you feel when people throw this out to you. Part of me wants to say, hey, if we're going to do the research and take all the risks and all that stuff, it's not cheap,
right.
But I don't really have a feel for what it really costs.
No, I hear you. And I think it's difficult when we're not yet talking about curative treatments, right? That's, to me, the issue, because it's all about a value discussion. What are we getting? What's the return on investment here for society for these drugs? And then, of course, for individual patients, the same. And if we were curing anybody with these drugs, I'd feel a lot better about the idea that it's worth it, kind of to invest these kinds of dollars. But for, quote unquote, palliative therapies that extend survival, both vemurafenib and ipilimumab clearly do, it's a lot to be putting on the table in terms of cost. Now, again, with vemurafenib, average course of therapy, just over a half a year. So when you start doing the calculus of what's the per year cost, well, the reality is, vast majority of patients don't make it a year on that treatment. And so therefore, it's quite a variable expense, if you will. Ipilimumab, though, the vast majority of patients get all four doses, in other words, before you do a response assessment. And so that's a fixed unit that's difficult. Now, just going back to this issue of cure as a real target, ultimately, for these expensive treatment approaches, what I would say about ipilimumab, as we'll talk about in terms of, what continues to defend its use, is that there are patients who are alive and well 6, 8, 10 years out from receiving investigational ipilimumab on clinical trials, having had four doses of therapy and nothing since. So maybe that's not cure when you can still see something on the scans, but it's awfully close. And so I think, yes, it's an expensive treatment, but the fact that it can do that and not for a trivial percentage of patients, that's what kind of balances that part of the equation.
So let's talk a little bit about clinical decision making. And right now, there are two main immune-based treatments that can be utilized upfront in a patient with BRAF-negative disease and even BRAF-positive disease, particularly if it's low volume, asymptomatic, high-dose IL-2 and ipilimumab. How do you think through that choice in terms of the sequence of those agents? And maybe you can talk a little bit about the databases for those two.
Yeah. So high-dose IL-2, of course, not a lot of new data. And so the issue then is, how does it fare with these new agents available? And what I still hold on to in talking to patients is the principles that if you're young, highly motivated, asymptomatic, low-volume disease, normal LDH, let me just throw that in there. In other words, you've got everything pointing in your favor in terms of your disease characteristics other than the fact that you've got metastatic melanoma. And when I say young, I mean less than 60, let's say, and if over 60 by a hair, then really in excellent, excellent health overall. Those who understand what they're deferring in terms of vemurafenib's non-curative and generally not particularly long-lasting effects, ipilimumab with its documented long-term potential benefit, but the subset, I'd say, look, we think about IL-2 now, and then we stop thinking about it. In other words, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it up front. Why do I say that? Because several groups, and in fact, we presented at ASCO and about to publish, our experience trying to give high-dose IL-2 after ipilimumab. And that was actually problematic. It was hard to give the drug the same number of doses safely.
How come?
We think that ipilimumab, once it instills its immune effect, even if it doesn't have the intended effect against the tumor, actually still lingers for quite a long time. You could say that's supported by the fact that there's long-term efficacy, even when patients don't clear their scans. If they're able to maintain responses for years, there probably is, you know, some really persistent effect from that treatment. So until we know a lot more on that topic, we consider high-dose IL-2 as a first-line therapy for those patients who, again, understand what they're up against. Now, if they're BRAF negative, consider the fact that their only new therapy they've got is ipilimumab. 10% objective response rate, and we can talk it through, but we think if you were to aggregate all the benefit that comes from that therapy beyond response rate, you're talking maybe 20, 25% of patients who are getting some significant mileage out of that therapy. Well, that's the minority, right? And we have evidence that ipilimumab following IL-2 doesn't change that, right? In other words, there doesn't seem to be cross-resistance, if you will. And so if you've got a patient who seems to have the runway to work with, we figure, well, look, IL-2 is a short course of treatment. You can judge response very quickly. And if they've had a response, you're potentially in business. If you are stable or progressing, on you go to ipilimumab. And you've got two sort of non-overlapping chances at long-term benefit from treatment. And that's really the point, is that if you think you can, quote-unquote, add those two therapies in terms of their benefit, that's what we try to do, especially for the BRAF-negative patients. The BRAF-positive patients, I'll admit, it's tough when you've got three treatments to sort through. And, I mean, as you can think back 5 years, how often were we ever talking about third-line therapy in metastatic melanoma, patients actually being able to hold together well enough to get through that? So there, it's really the patients who have the lowest of low disease burden. And you almost have to find those people either by accident, meaning scans that were done for some other reason, sometime out from a diagnosis of primary melanoma, or if you're doing surveillance scans in a high-risk population, let's say stage 3 population, you might pick up these really low-volume patients.
What do you say to patients who are considering high-dose IL-2 in terms of, you know, globally, kind of what the chance is they're going to have a significant benefit?
Yeah, so my estimate of that is based on the most recently published evidence on patient selection, which follows the paradigm that I mentioned before. The age thing, of course, is partly about just getting through the therapy safely. But beyond that, it's normal LDH, asymptomatic, absolutely critical. Got to have both of those features. I mean, no cough, no nothing related. I don't mean maintain performance status. I mean asymptomatic. And if you use those parameters, then you can quote a 5 to 7% chance of long-term survival, more like a 15% chance of response up front, but do the math and you subtract out those ones that unfortunately aren't maintained. So basically, patients to this day, if they're signing up for that treatment, are hoping for that 5 to 7% chance. And as I said, the available evidence that ipilimumab still preserves its effect even if it's used after IL-2.
How do you conceptualize the anti-tumor mechanism of high-dose IL-2?
You know, to me, based on every attempt to try to show a direct anti-tumor effect, it doesn't seem to be there. It purely seems to be through the immune system and, best evidence, T cells. The same target, if you will, as ipilimumab. Very different way, of course. IL-2 is a growth factor for T cells. It drives activation of them in ways that are not simple to reduce down to a single mechanism, but it can have pleiotropic effects on lymphocyte activation, some of which produce the toxicity of the therapy, but some of them can unleash pre-existing T cells that know how to recognize the tumor but are being inhibited in terms of attacking it.
Maybe we can talk a little bit about the side effects and tolerability issues with ipilimumab. What do you generally see clinically, and what kinds of questions do you get or problems do you see people running into in the community?
Yeah, so, I mean, first let me paint the picture of the trajectory of the side effects. So it's four doses of therapy at three-week intervals. So just imagine the few months that it takes to get, you know, through that course of treatment. The first week of treatment followed by the 2 weeks of follow-up, so call that a three-week cycle. Generally speaking, you're not going to find patients with much of a complaint of anything in that time frame. After the second dose, but increasingly likely after the third dose and fourth dose, that's when the common toxicities manifest. So oftentimes the first sign of toxicity will be a skin effect, rash, or itching without a rash, oftentimes followed by the other, right? In other words, a rash that comes that doesn't itch will oftentimes, with a little more time, start to itch, and then same itchy skin, you'll start to see a rash a little bit later. But it's a gradual thing. None of this is hour by hour. You're talking day by day at its worst, and sometimes it can be even more gradual than that. Diarrhea can show up relatively early. In my experience, usually a little later than the skin effects. But certainly by the time a patient has received the third dose or so, we're really on the lookout for the diarrhea. Of course, we tell them at day one and every subsequent visit, look, you just have to be really vigilant in looking out for these things. And as trivial as they may seem to you, you got to let us know. It's not so much because there's an hour by hour concern. It's because the patients are only getting treated once every 3 weeks. And we really need to sort of assess the problem in between that interval. If they're having diarrhea one day and it picks up the next day, we want to know about it. We're going to have them take Imodium. And this is the typical algorithm, if you will. But if they keep developing diarrhea through Imodium and you scale up, let's say, to 2 tablets 4 times a day, which in my book is kind of maximum dose Imodium, and they're still having diarrhea, multiple bowel movements, watery per day, you know, that's it. They've actually now defined themselves as having severe autoimmune colitis. Yes, some people might bother to get a colonoscopy, but I wouldn't wait for that. I would actually not only not give further doses of the drug, but I'd institute corticosteroids right then and there. Now, backing up to the rash, sure, I've seen cases where that can build into being a really symptomatic problem, but you can use topical measures, oral antihistamines to manage the itch, and that's a pretty uncommon occasion for either discontinuing dosing or having to give corticosteroids. We focus so much more attention on the colitis issue because, you know, in the published data, there are bowel perforations that can happen. Thankfully, it's only a couple few percent of patients, but that can be fatal, even if you recognize it on the spot. So we take that very, very seriously. And then what I always tell patients is those are the big two, rash and diarrhea. But number 3 and number 4 are silent things that we're going to depend on the laboratories to tell us. And that's liver toxicity and endocrine toxicity. So the thyroid is sort of the focus of that, but the pituitary and the adrenal glands independently can be attacked. And so we generally do an endocrine panel every 3 weeks before each dose, recognizing you don't get those values back until after the dose is given, but you just got to collect the information. We do make a treatment decision based on the liver. So patients feeling totally well, but they've got 7X on their transaminases, at least for now, no more doses of ipilimumab. And in fact, if they're 10X or higher, we will absolutely give corticosteroids, which will reverse just about everything we've talked about in terms of the toxicity. But we're conservative in terms of jumping in too early with them because, look, nothing will kill lymphocytes better than steroids. That's been known for as long as treatment of autoimmune disease has existed. And we don't want to kill the anti-tumor ones or we've sort of shot the whole therapy. That has been the historical concern. The clinical data would suggest that if you wait until severe autoimmune toxicity manifests, then you're okay. In other words, those patients won't have a lower response rate or survival time compared to those who had lesser degrees of toxicity.
So what about future strategies, particularly anti-PD-1?
Well, that is definitely soaking up most of the oxygen these days because whereas beyond BRAF, we've got BRAF-MEK, but nothing on the horizon that we can point to for how to improve that approach. Some ideas in early clinical trials, sure. In the immunotherapy realm, we've got IPI with its clear 10% response rate. Let's give it a 20-25% fraction of patients who seem to be getting some significant mileage. The PD-1 antibodies and PD-L1 antibodies, which are highly related, as we can talk about, there are multiple of them now, and we have significant amounts of data on two of them, MDX1106 and the antibody MK3475. These are very similar drugs. Those two both target PD-1 itself. And we heard at ASCO last year and published simultaneously in New England Journal a 30% response rate, 30% objective responses, forget about stable disease, objective responses to the PD-1 antibody MDX1106. At a smaller melanoma meeting this past fall, we heard about a 50% objective response rate in about 100 melanoma patients treated with the Merck PD-1 antibody, MK3475. 30 to 50% response rate? Again, we're not even yet in the position to exactly judge, well, can patients have long-term stable disease and so on beyond that, which the short answer seems to be yes. But you're talking about drugs that seem to be multiplying the benefit of what we observe with ipilimumab.
And what do we know about duration of response at this point?
Yeah, a bit early to tell, except that for the most mature data we've got, it's clear that 2 and 3 year responses and ongoing are possible. Furthermore, that patients can receive the treatment and stop the treatment and still maintain their responses thereafter. So, you know, I tend to talk to patients about a 2 to 3 year duration of response that seems to be reliable, reproducible, and more likely, right, than what we've seen with ipilimumab and its 10% response rate. But with ipi, we've got, you know, these 8-10 year responders, so we know that that type of durability can be seen, and we just don't know that yet with these PD-1 drugs.
And what about tolerability? I'm kind of getting the feeling that it's maybe better tolerated than ipi, for example.
Yeah, so if you just follow the strict numbers, it looks like severe autoimmune toxicity, which is that's the only type of toxicity that ipi causes, about half in terms of, you know, grade 3, grade 4 type of events on clinical trials. But if you look at the whole profile, looks like it might be even less toxicity overall than that. In other words, maybe even a bigger cut than just half. Don't see colitis and bowel perforations. The unique concerning toxicity that's been seen, unique to PD-1 compared to ipi, have been a few cases of pneumonitis. There's actually a good reason for that, because PD-1, PD-L1 are actually expressed, PD-L1 specifically, on lung tissue, and it's thought that that might be why we see that, because you're disrupting immune recognition there.
And what about the time course in terms of response and progression with these immune therapies? It's been stated, and particularly in the anti-PD-1, there were actually scans in the New England Journal paper where you saw people actually progressing and then responding without any of the treatment changing.
Right. So that was best characterized for ipi years ago, the idea that you could get all 4 doses of treatment, have a response assessment, have some worsening, and in some cases, although uncommonly, have that all turn around. The PD-1 antibodies seem to follow a similar script, but interestingly, there have been earlier response assessments in the PD-1 clinical trials than had been done historically in the ipi trials, and responses can be seen right away, meaning 2 months of treatment, let's say. And in fact, there are patients who have symptomatic or, let's say, cutaneous disease that you can watch kind of continuously through treatment who clearly manifest responses sometimes even within the first month. So this is early days in judging these data sets, but we've got hundreds of patients treated to look at where it would seem like the PD-1 antibodies can have that delayed effect, but can have an earlier dynamic as well compared to what we've gotten used to with ipi.
And where are these agents in terms of potential approval?
Well, good question. Now, I think the sponsors of these drug trials are not taking any chances in the sense that you'll see listed phase 3 trials with each of them. Now, of course, many of us wonder whether that's the only way to think about approval here. There are smaller phase 2 trials that are also ongoing, particularly in ipi refractory patients. And you'd say, well, for a BRAF negative patient in particular, who's already had ipi, what have we got? Well, we don't have much, right? Chemotherapy that still has never shown a survival advantage in this disease. And so that, I think, is still considered an absolutely open space. If one could see a high double-digit response rate and relatively little in the way of severe autoimmune toxicity and durability in those responses, you know, you'd have to consider that would be grounds for approval as well. So these trials are ongoing. The issue is which type of data would be enough to push any one of these over the line.
And you hear those kinds of numbers and you kind of think, gee, I'd kind of like to have that available now.
I hear you. And it's been a pretty uncomfortable time, to be honest with you, in the academic melanoma community, in the sense that all the centers who've been involved in one or several of these drugs, we tell our patients, okay, well, you know, here's my treatment recommendation if we forget about these drugs, but if one of these trials has an opening and you can get on, that changes everything. And that's definitely a paradigm change. We always used to focus on clinical trials in the era of no therapy. But when we've got these treatments and to have our treatment and our counseling of patients be so divergent based on like the month or the week within the month where one of these ongoing trials might give us a handful of slots, you have exactly that sense that basically, look, if we had the choice, we'd be offering this as standard treatment to patients based on the available evidence we've got right now. And frankly, the fact that, you know, overall survival landscape hasn't been shifted so much. Half the patients have a BRAF mutation, and yes, we improve survival, but in a measured way. And ipi, unfortunately, produces magnificent effects, but in a relatively small minority of patients.
You referred to chemotherapy, and I mean, that still is an option, I think, that a lot of patients are receiving before they die. Any thoughts about the data that came out recently looking at nab-paclitaxel?
Yeah, well, you know, the gap in what we've discussed so far is the high disease burden BRAF negative patient. And for that patient who walks in the door with that setting, or they develop that setting even after ipilimumab, we'd like to have a cytotoxic approach. We don't have a targeted therapy approach yet like BRAF. So chemotherapy of some sort is still on the radar for that patient. And based on available evidence, NCCN guidelines, everything mixed together, many clinicians favor carboplatin paclitaxel for that patient because, you know, hundreds of patients were treated that way on several trials, you know, to not defeat dacarbazine. That wasn't the purpose of those studies, but using it essentially as a new investigational backbone. And so given that data and the comfort using that approach, of course, because medical oncologists use that regimen all the time, nab-paclitaxel, which is, of course, another agent that's got a fair amount of comfort level to it, having been approved in breast cancer some years ago, now we've got data that it's better than dacarbazine. And you can't say the same of carboplatin-paclitaxel as a doublet, that we've got that clear evidence.
Could you go through what was looked at in that study?
Yeah, it was a phase 3 trial comparing nab-paclitaxel single agent against dacarbazine in treatment-naive patients. They had to be in pretty good shape when you consider that there was a cap on the LDH, 2 times upper limit of normal or lower. Now, remember I was just saying that the most tempting population to use chemotherapy in is the patients who've got high disease burden. They almost always have some degree of LDH elevation. But in any case, within that more constrained population, it's still the case with PFS as the primary endpoint, progression-free survival as the primary endpoint, that the trial met its endpoint. It showed an improvement in progression-free survival. It was about doubling of the progression-free survival. I'll admit that dacarbazine is pretty weak in that regard, but nonetheless, response rate that was just, you know, a little bit better, but I put more emphasis on the progression-free survival, not only because it was the primary endpoint, but there's a reason why it was the primary endpoint. I mean, disease control is sort of certainly more of a relevant metric in my view, since responses, unfortunately, are not seen all that commonly with chemo. And what we know less about still to this moment is, does it really improve survival? Now, mind you, for the patient who's exhausted other options and you're thinking about chemo of some sort, I'm not sure I'd be holding my breath waiting for more survival follow-up before making a decision about the treatment. And so I think, of course, we're not going to have direct comparisons between carboplatin paclitaxel and nab-paclitaxel. But as your listeners well know, single-agent chemo, nab-paclitaxel, is going to be better tolerated. And if it shows a margin over dacarbazine, which is what we've seen now in the phase 3 trial, yeah, that'd be a reasonable selection for those patients.
Just out of curiosity, how many times have you used chemotherapy in a patient with melanoma, you know, say in the last year, and have you used NAB at all?
Yeah, probably 10 times in the past year. Again, we get there with a lot of patients, and you know, you're asking someone who's got a huge portfolio of clinical trials to tap into. So, of course, we'll preferentially put patients who've exhausted options otherwise onto trials. But still, there's patients who, you know, they're symptomatic, they don't have the time to wait, and that's when it comes up. You know, we've still used, in my practice, carboplatin paclitaxel as our standard because we adopted it, you know, a few years ago, and we only just recently got the data in hand on nab-paclitaxel. Certainly, I can envision the patient coming in who's a little older, their overall health isn't quite as good, where doublet chemotherapy isn't really a compelling option from the toxicity perspective, where I could absolutely see adopting nab-paclitaxel as my standard. But defensively, it could be used in any patient.
What do we know about paclitaxel compared to nab? Obviously, it hasn't been compared directly, but any sense of the difference?
Yeah, if you look at the data with paclitaxel and melanoma, single agent, several trials looked at this, phase 2 trials years ago. The response rate and progression-free survival does not really look better than dacarbazine. So now we've got this evidence of a clear difference head-to-head against dacarbazine that makes me think that I wouldn't make the leap that paclitaxel, standard paclitaxel, even at, let's say, 225 per meter squared, is really going to measure up.
So maybe we just close out with a couple of questions that we've gotten from oncologists in practice. Just throw them out there at you for melanoma. How do you treat stage 4 NED melanoma post-resection? Has a patient with a lung lesion that was removed, BRAF mutant, and what would you do if it were BRAF wild?
Yeah, well, I think I would lump these two together because if they are BRAF mutant or wild type, for the BRAF mutant even, I wouldn't use a BRAF inhibitor. We don't know about the curative potential of that therapy flat out in the adjuvant setting, stage 3, stage 4. And the fact is we know that it can engender resistance, and that resistance can be difficult to treat. So knowing that some stage 4 patients can go years before having a recurrence, I'd rather have that, the disease-free interval, if you will, protected. Yes, they're very high risk for ultimate recurrence, but I'd rather measure out my time off therapy for that patient than choose a BRAF inhibitor. I think ipilimumab is a tempting option for patients who are, again, sufficiently motivated that they're willing to take on the toxicity profile of ipilimumab for those patients. To be totally clear, as you know, we have no direct evidence of a stage 4 resected patient having an adjuvant therapy. Interferon was barely tested in that situation and didn't really hold up compared to its lower stage 3 use. And so we don't formally have any direct evidence that would nominate any particular treatment. But as a patient who's got that lung nodule, a metastatic patient, you know, you're histologically confirming them with the resection, are they a candidate for ipilimumab by FDA label and everything else? Sure. The issue about taking it on as a treatment approach, I don't think it's going to work better than it's going to work in the lung nodule in place based on the lack of adjuvant evidence yet with IPI. We'll get that, but we don't have it yet. I would say that that patient just has to understand that they're taking on small, very small chance of fatal toxicity, very real chance of severe autoimmune toxicity, some of which is not reversible, at least, I mean, where patients are going to have to be on something, endocrine therapy, for example, you know, potentially lifelong. Those are the real downsides in my mind as to why I am cautious about that approach. But admittedly, you put that same lung nodule just a little too close to the hilum and really sort of deemed unresectable because you'd have to be taking out maybe the entire lung. Well, yeah, sure, we'd be talking about ipilimumab in that patient. So that's a fine line.
So final question, 50-year-old patient has a good PR for 12 months after ipilimumab and then starts progressing. Would you reinduce with ipilimumab?
Yeah, if they've had a good response, we'd do it. The data from the published literature, admittedly, this exercise was only performed for a subset of patients, but those who had objective responses one time and then had more than 6 months pass and then progressed and rechallenged, they clearly had a response rate that was higher than the upfront patients. I mean, we're talking a 40, 50% response rate compared to 10% response rate. So that they're telling you that they're biologically ready, if you will. We don't know mechanistically exactly why that would work reasonably reliably in that setting, but it's certainly in my practice, we do it because we think it's probably a higher response rate than we've got with most of the other therapies we could turn to.